Hey, is work driving you mad? It may be time to make some changes for a more positive experience at the office. A new study finds that job strain raises a person's risk of suffering from mental disorders, including depression and anxiety, particularly in middle-aged employees. Jeez, it's everywhere. In a moment, Dean Slider's back with us on Coast to Coast, his latest work, Fear Less. That's what we're going to talk about on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Fascinating couple hours ahead for you. Dean Slider has taught meditation and awakening throughout the country and beyond since 1970. From corporate boardrooms to maximum security prisons, he's completed numerous long retreats and journeys in India, Tibet, and the West, studying personally with some of the preeminent sages on the planet. His latest work is called Fearless: Living Beyond Fear, Anxiety, Anger, and Addiction. Dean, always a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks, George. It's great to be back.
Boy, that story about the work environment, how people can get tense and anxiety, it must be everywhere, huh?
Oh, it is absolutely everywhere. You know, I travel around the country a lot. I teach workshops in, you know, every part of the map. And I'm finding it's happening a lot, especially with younger people. I go on college campuses, and the counselors tell me that 5 years ago, the kids were all talking about depression, and now they are lining up to talk about anxiety. Anxiety, this kind of free-floating anxiety where people know they're afraid, but they're not sure what to be afraid of, you know, what direction is the next threat going to come from. I've found out there's some college campuses now where they've got therapy dogs in every dorm because it's just so prevalent.
I've been told by some people who have had anxiety attacks that they almost think they are dying on the spot. Is it that bad?
Yeah, it is. It is. And it's, you know, there's this underlying fear that I think, you know, everyone has almost, and that word almost is very important. Almost everyone has this underlying fear that no matter how well things are going, no matter how well we get things under control, you know, someday either you're going to be standing in the middle of the road with a Mack truck bearing down on you, or you're going to be sitting in some doctor's office being told something that you don't want to hear, mm-hmm. and it's going to be game over. So there's this sense that, annihilation is waiting. You know, it's always one heartbeat. You miss one heartbeat, and that's it. You're done. And so, you know, everything, I think, gets interpreted as a sort of a part of that threat. Anything that comes along that threatens our sense of who we think we are, how things are supposed to be going, where we're supposed to be going in life, it feels like it's a part of that threat of annihilation, that we're just going to get wiped out.
Are people afraid of dying, generally?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I think that a lot of people would say, well, I never think about it, but I think it's just pushed into some corner of the mind. You know, people think, most people, their the model that they have of reality is that, okay, I'm this thing. I'm just this carbon-based organism, you know, 170 pounds, 5'10". I go from here to here, and then I stop. It's like being a wave on the surface of the ocean. I'm just one wave, and everything else is so much bigger than I am. And all those other waves I see sooner or later, they crash against the shore and they cease to be. And I guess that's going to happen to me.
I was talking about Frank Sinatra a couple days ago. And, of course, we would have been 100 years old.
Right.
And I just got an email from the son of a woman who starred in a couple movies with him. And it's just amazing to hear these kind of stories, Dean. But the bottom line is she's passed away, too, because I did a little wiki check. I wanted to see where was she. And she died a couple of years ago. And it's inevitable that all of us are going to get it by the clock one day or another.
Yeah.
And I guess the biggest fear for most people is they haven't completed what they need to do yet. Is that a factor?
Yeah. In fact, a couple of stories that I tell in the book really bear on this. By the way, I want to mention that the title of the book is two words. It's fearless.
Fearless.
Not fearless. I'm not fearless. I've never met anyone who's fearless. I've met the Dalai Lama, and he's not fearless. I tell the story in the book. He's afraid of worms. but he laughs about it, and that's how things change.
I hate clowns. I'm not afraid of clowns, but I hate clowns.
Yeah, right. Get thee behind me, clown.
Yeah.
Let's see. We're going to tell a story
about basically people are going to die. They're going to reach that age where they're gone, and some of them, of course, nobody wants to just die.
Right.
Unless you've at least accomplished what you need to do.
Right. And one story that I tell in the book is about something that I heard from my 10th grade English teacher. And he told a story about his father. And his father was one of these remarkable people. He'd been a sailor. He'd been everything. He'd been all over the world. He'd been with all kinds of women. He'd had every adventure you could imagine. And when he died, he literally died screaming because he felt that whatever life was about, he had missed it.
Gee, screaming like in pain or just screaming?
Screaming like in anguish.
Like no!
Like I missed it. Like I
really?
Missed the point. I missed the movie, yeah. And that story always haunted me. It always, that was one of the kind of little things along the way that really made me look around and say, okay, what's it all about? Whatever that guy missed, I don't want to make the same mistake. Now, on the other hand, when my first wife, Maggie, was dying of cancer, and she was a person, and she, like me, was a meditation teacher. We'd been on long retreats together, and she, you know, as far as I could tell at this point in life, we had both sort of seen what was that thing that people missed, that the other guy was screaming about missing. And she'd gotten things, she pretty well assimilated that thing, that bigger thing in her life. So when she reached the point, you know, where the cancer was clearly terminal and there was nothing more they could do for her and she was out of it on medication, and the decision was made to take her off of the nutrition, the artificial nutrition. And I asked the nurse, and one thing I learned, by the way, is if you really want to know the score, ask the nurses, don't ask the doctors. So I took a little walk down the corridor with the nurse and I said, well, now that we've disconnected the nutrition, how long will it be until she goes? And she said, it could be anything from a day to a month, depending on how much she feels she's completed her life or whether she feels there's unfinished business. And then Maggie went in less than a day. She went in about half a day. So, you know, I felt good about that.
I get calls from people who want to know, and they ask me, if there's life after death. And the stories I've told people, if you die and there is life after death, you're going to know about it, obviously.
Right.
If there isn't, if it simply ends the moment you die, don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it. You're not going to be sitting there going, damn, I'm not here.
Exactly. It's not going to happen that way.
Right. And, you know, on one level, and I know you've had Brian Weiss as a guest.
Yes, many times.
And you've had, I believe, Jim Tucker on the show. And, you know, they tell some pretty convincing stories about people's memories of past lives and so forth. To me, the big picture is that, first of all, as one of my teachers, a Tibetan Lama that I used to study with, as he put it, look, if we're smart enough to recycle our cans and bottles, don't you think the universe is smart enough to recycle us?
That's right. Good point.
Yeah. You know, why? It certainly feels as if we're here, we're learning things. In the course of a lifetime, if you're not learning, if you're not expanding, if you're not becoming more understanding of other people and compassionate and loving and open and understanding of who you are and what it's all about, then, you know, you're missing the point. It's really like we're in a school And the general scheme of things, and you know, whether you're reading the Hindu sources or the Buddhist sources or the early Christian sources, which were later edited out, you know, the details vary. But in general, the picture is like, okay, you're in this school and you attend school from September until June, and then you go away for a little while. You're not seen out on the school ground for a while, and then you come back in September, and you're in the next grade, unless you're really screwed up and they flunk you back a grade or two. And when you come back in September, are you the same person? Kinda. Are you a different person? Kinda.
When people fear, isn't that a built-in mechanism within our bodies just for survival?
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why the title of the book is not Fearless, but Fearless. Fear, a certain amount of fear is a healthy thing. We're programmed with just the right amount of fear so that
we have to have that.
Yeah, we have a natural fear of snakes, which is healthy because that way we're going to have a healthy respect enough to avoid the ones that are poisonous. On the other hand, I've got a friend who can't walk into a pet store because just in case there are snakes there in the glass tanks, she's afraid they're going to smash through the glass, fly through the air, and jump into her face.
Huh.
So she's got to learn to fear less. And what I do in the book, by the way, is I give people a lot of little methods. I like to, you know, kind of like I throw a lot of different strands of spaghetti against the wall and, you know, try a few of these things and see which ones really, you know, what sticks to the wall for you. One very simple thing, and actually this one is running on the Oprah.com website. She excerpted this and it's on her. I like to say she, like Oprah personally.
Well, you never know. She's a workaholic.
You never know.
She may be running in 2020 for the presidency.
Well, stay tuned.
You never know.
So this little two-page chapter from the book that's running on the Oprah.com website is Breathe Through Your Feet. And it's very simply this. And actually, people listening can do this right now, whether you're sitting comfortably at home or you can even do... This is one kind of meditation you can do while you're driving. And that is... Put your attention on the soles of your feet. Just notice, okay, here's what the soles of my feet feel like. And then as you breathe in, just normal breathing, as you breathe in, imagine you're breathing in through the soles of your feet. Then as you breathe out, imagine you're breathing out through the soles of your feet. And again, in through the soles of your feet and out through the soles of your feet. And that's it. And I'll tell you, I've been getting emails from people all over the country telling me, you know, that thing is so stupid simple, but I find I do that for half a minute and I'm sleeping better. And it's just, the thing is, if you're, let's say you're driving, someone cuts you off, you're getting caught.
You get a road rage.
In the road rage situation, you're about to do something that you're going to really regret. Or let's say, you've got a public speaking situation coming up. They're introducing you. You hate getting up in front of people and speaking. So while, you know, before you flip off the guy in the next car or before you get up to the microphone, you take a few moments, breathe in and out through the soles of your feet. And the fact that you're doing that means you can't be totally caught up in the rage or in the fear because there's a part of you that's doing that. That's doing the breathing through the soles of your feet. There's a part of you that's free from that. I got one email a couple of weeks ago from a person saying, I breathe through my feet now when I'm going to bed, and you're going to put Ambien out of business.
Ha! Huh. Now, why does it work?
Well, it's funny. I got one email.
I'm going to try this.
Yeah, yeah. It's so simple.
Not during the show. But
Yeah, no. Stay with us, George. I got one email from a yoga teacher in Texas who said, oh, when you gave that method of breathing through your feet, I'm sure you were referring to the anatomical studies of Dr. Such and Such, who showed that there's a connection between the arches of the feet and the epiglottis and the the autonomic nervous system and something. I don't even remember exactly.
So he's saying there's a medical reason.
That there's a medical reason. And I say, okay, fine. But to tell you the truth, I get this stuff just through practice. For example, here's another example. There's a method of breathing, and anyone listening to this who's taken yoga classes is probably familiar with what they call ujjayi breath or ocean breath. I call it Darth Vader breath. This is the thing where you do a little constriction in the back of your throat, so as you breathe in and out, you sound like Darth Vader. It's like...
That was pretty good, Bob. Luke.
Right. Now, so the yogis, thousands of years ago, practicing in the jungles of India, discovered through trial and error, trying different ways of breathing, that if you breathe that way, it has a very profound tranquilizing effect. It completely cools your jets. Now, centuries later, it was discovered why that works. And it's because when you do that constriction in the back of your throat, it stimulates the vagus nerve, which is the longest nerve in the autonomic nervous system. It actually goes from the bottom of your brain all the way down to the diaphragm, and stimulating the vagus nerve switches off the sympathetic nervous system and switches on the parasympathetic. And what that does is it switches off the fight or flight syndrome and switches on the opposite syndrome, what we could call the stay and play syndrome.
Now, how do you weigh fear and anxiety? Because they're two different things, aren't they?
Yeah, they're closely related. In general, fear will be related to something specific, whether, as we were discussing before, I'm afraid of dying, or I'm afraid of public speaking, or I have fear of flying. Anxiety is generally more free-floating. It's just that same visceral feeling, that same kind of fluttery feeling is there, and we don't necessarily have a sense of what is causing it. Fortunately, the same methods pretty much work for both of them, these same kinds of, for lack of a better word, we say, meditative methods. I try to shy away. I mean, I'm a meditation teacher. I'm stuck with that word. But I don't like the word meditation because most people associate that word with something where you're, working really hard. It's like you're trying to push this boulder up a mountain, and it's really hard work, but someday when you get to the top, it'll be worth it. That kind of approach is actually self-defeating. And what I've learned from my teachers in Indian tradition and Tibetan tradition is really just let gravity take over and pull the rock down to the bottom, and that's where the settling takes place. So you allow yourself to be pulled. You're just going the way of ease. I'm way too lazy to do it the hard way, so I had to do it the easy way.
Is anxiety mental or medical?
It's both. All this stuff, there's something called the mind-body connection, and it's always a two-way street.
Yeah.
For example, one of the chapters in the book is titled Resting Bliss Face. Okay? And what I do there is I give some methods of smiling. And especially if you're feeling in a grouchy mood or you're depressed.
Hold on, Dean. Let's take a break. Let's come back and talk about that. Smiling, an interesting take. We're going to come back in a moment. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls. If you've had an anxiety attack, share it with us. We'll be back. And welcome back to Coast, Dean Slider back with us. His book, Fear Less, Living Beyond Fear, Anxiety, Anger, and Addiction. And Dean, you were talking about smiles. What is that?
Right. We were talking about smiles, and we were talking about the fact that the mind-body connection always works in both directions. And in this case, there's something called the facial feedback hypothesis, which goes all the way back to Charles Darwin. He was the first one who started to explore that. And what it comes down to is that obviously when we feel happy, it tends to make us smile. But also, if we can smile in an authentic way, it makes us feel happy. And there's a couple of different approaches to this that I share in the book. My favorite one, because it's just a lot of fun, is you throw up your hands and you say, "Whee!" And
right in the middle of public, right?
And then well, this one you might want to do in the privacy of your home. Pull the shades down. You know, you're waking up in the morning, you're feeling grouchy. But seriously, especially, you know, depression is not a laughing matter for a lot of people. And if you're suffering from depression, throwing up, flinging your hands up and saying, "Wee," is the last thing you're going to want to do. You're going to think, that just sounds ridiculous.
We've lost it when you get to that point, right?
Yeah, but you know what? In my workshops, I get, you know, everyone in the joint all together doing this, 1, 2, 3, "Wee," and we'll do that 3 times, and I'll say, "Now, try to be depressed." And you cannot do it. You cannot feel depression after you do that a couple of times because of that feedback mechanism. See, you can't say "wee" without smiling because of just the psychoacoustic properties of that sound. It forces your face muscles into a smile, and you can't feel depressed then.
Tell me about anti-anxiety medications. Do they work or not?
Well, you know, I think a whole lot of it, there's a whole lot of overprescription. There's a whole lot of, I don't want to say in a blanket way, no one should ever take medication. I mean, for example, I've known of cases of, you know, people with bipolar disorder and so forth. And, you know, sometimes the deal is to find just the right medication cocktail to get your chemistry back toward the middle of the road, back toward the normal part of the spectrum, and then hopefully do some of these meditative methods so that you start tapping in a more natural way into freedom from anxiety and depression and all that. And then often the need for medication will fall away. But largely, especially anti-anxiety medication, I would say, I don't want to say all of that, but I'll say I think most of that could be eliminated simply by the knowledge of these very simple methods. I'd say that if you're taking anti-anxiety medication and you haven't at least tried even a couple of the things we've already said, saying "we" or the ujjayi, the Darth Vader breath, or breathing through your feet, you know, give that a try in a thoroughgoing way. You know, dedicate at least a few minutes to that each day and see what happens.
Well, it would be better to do that than I think stay on drugs.
Yeah, but I mean, again, I want to be careful here because I'm not a doctor.
You're not a doctor. I understand that. You're not telling anybody to stop.
Right. But what I would say is that try adding this stuff to your life, and if a doctor has told you to take those drugs, let him know what you're doing, or let her know what you're doing. And if you start realizing you're feeling better in a natural way, tell the doctor and maybe get the prescription. Especially if the prescription says as needed, then you know that, hey, I don't need this as much anymore as I used to.
Did you see the video of the road rage episode last week?
No.
This individual's in a pickup truck, follows a little SUV into a parking lot, gets out of his pickup truck with a sledgehammer, and he starts smashing the SUV. The guy drove away, and then somebody else was there, and the guy went up and clubbed him with the sledgehammer. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
What causes somebody to be that ticked off?
There's some crazy people out there.
There are.
But you know, I think in the last analysis, it comes back to what we were talking about before. Everyone knows that one day they're going to die. Everyone knows, you know, we wake up with this assumption, I'm not going to die today. But we really know that one of these days we're going to be wrong about that. And so everything is potentially it's a threat to our safety. It's a threat to our security. And there's always people around. There's always politicians around who are happy to exploit that fear and go, okay, it's those guys, you know, it's that tribe in the other end of the valley that is causing all your problems. Be afraid of them. Or it's those people who look different from you that's causing all your problems, you know, go after them. And one of the good things about using these methods to start getting back in tune with your inner freedom, which is the natural state, really, is that you're less susceptible to being, I mean, in my opinion, you know, hoodwinked by these people who are trying to exploit your fears.
You have your own thoughts about reincarnation. Tell us about that.
It seems to me that it makes sense for that things work that way. One of the things that a lot of people experience after they practice meditation for a while is that it becomes clearer and clearer that you're not just, you know, a slab of meat walking around with some electrical activity up inside your head that makes you, you know, conscious of things. That it's that you're not just this separate entity that is isolated from the rest of the universe. That it's more like the way I think of it is it's as if we're the stream of time is like a river. And as the water is moving downstream, each of us is like we're like a little whirlpool. You know, you look at the whirlpool and you say, well, it's got a definite shape and it's going in a definite direction. But if you look closely, you see it's not separate from the river. And it doesn't have anything that is, it doesn't have any substance, any separate identity other than the river. Now, after a while, the little whirlpool hits a rock or something and it disperses. We don't see that whirlpool anymore. But the energy, the momentum from that whirlpool when it hit the rock continues to move downstream, and after a while it kind of gathers together again, and now it becomes a different little whirlpool. So I think of so-called reincarnation or rebirth as being like that. We're really just part of this continuum, which we can call awareness or existence or the universe. And for a little while, we seem to be, we look like a separate part of it, and then we, as I was saying earlier, we learn, we expand our ability to be compassionate and to love and to understand. And then once we can't get any further in this vehicle, we trade that vehicle in, we pick up another one.
Have you been with anybody, Dean, who is in the midst of having an anxiety attack?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Especially.
It's scary, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it is. And this is why I'm so grateful to the teachers that I've been with, that they've shown me ways to help myself and help others when this happens. And to just say, okay, just, you know, even to say, for example, a lot of people, when they have anxiety attacks, they'll start breathing through their mouth. You know, that
right.
Kind of thing.
Deep and heavy.
Yeah. And if you can, sometimes it's just enough to say, okay, breathe through your nose. Right, that's simple, and then the other kinds of methods. There's one of my favorite things in the book, actually, which is very helpful with this sort of thing, is the chapter is called "The Sweetest Dog in the World," and it's a little meditation where you close your eyes and imagine that whatever the thing is that's making you feel that anxiety attack or the rage or the fear, whatever it is, imagine the sweetest dog in the world is sitting there and you're telling your story to him or to her. You're just pouring it out. And the great thing about a dog as the listener, as the therapist, is that the dog doesn't understand a word you're saying, but he understands the underlying feelings, and he pays complete attention. He doesn't interrupt. He doesn't bring in his own story. He doesn't disagree or even agree. He just brings it all in through his sweet, loving doggy eyes, and then kind of explodes it into his doggy heart, and just explodes that energy harmlessly out into the universe.
What would you recommend people who are having an anxiety attack, wherever they may be? They could be at their office, they could be out on a setting. I have a friend of mine who is a professional ring announcer, and he got hit by an anxiety attack in the middle of one of the rounds while he was in the round, you know, doing his thing.
Wow.
And I think it was being televised with Don King, and he thought he was going to die.
Yeah.
So he's in the middle of the ring doing the boxing announcing.
Right.
He's got his little cue cards in his hand, and he gets hit with this.
Right.
And he thought it was over.
Right.
I would guess that if you could see it on his face, you would have seen it at that time.
Right. Well, one thing, if you know that you're prone to these attacks.
And what makes it creep up like that? Nobody knows.
Well, yeah, we can't. You know, there's a line in the Bhagavad Gita, the great text of Indian wisdom, that says unfathomable are the ways of karma, and karma meaning just, you know, cause and effect in all its ramifications. It's just so complicated. Who knows? Fortunately, we don't have to know. Now, here's the thing: if you know you're prone to panic attacks, or for that matter, to rage attacks or anything, you want to do the fire drill before the fire. So
test it out?
Yeah. The thing is, practice some of this stuff when you're calm, when you're just sitting at home and everything is okay, so that, because otherwise when the panic attack comes, you're not going to remember. But if you practice the thing a few times, you've done the drill, you're okay, right, I do that. Now, one that a lot of people find is really good in these panic attacks is just that one we were doing before. Just breathe through your feet. Feel the soles of your feet as you breathe in. Breathe in through the soles.
And how long do you have to do that?
Till things start to lighten up.
It could be
a few minutes. It could be one full breath in and one full breath out. Now, let me give you another one, because this is one of my personal favorites. And
better than the feet breathing?
This is another one.
Okay.
And this is again, a drill that I do. I do this one every morning in the shower. And it's singing what in music is called a descending fifth. For the musicians out there, it means like going from like an E to an A. The easy way to remember this is Flintstones. Right? Ah, meet the Flintstones. Ah, or
ding, 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 ding.
Yeah, or the opening of the Star Spangled Banner. Oh, say, ah. Right? Now, a lot of people know this.
How about the sound from Close Encounters? Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah, I think
Close?
You're right.
It might be it.
It's, you know, it's all over the place. It's ironic. It's in the opening of the Star Spangled Banner and on the other side of the Mason-Dixon line, Dixie. I wish I was in the land of cotton, right? And a lot of people know this one from church. Amen. Now, the reason it's so prevalent, and it's in every scale, major, minor, every kind of music, Eastern, Western, because that descending fifth, the fifth is as far away as you can get from the root note, until you start getting closer to it in the next octave. So it's the point of maximum tension in terms of the sound vibrations. And then when you come back down to the lower note, it's the release of tension. So,
But like why does that work?
Tension release. Well, for just that reason, because it's acoustically maximum tension and then the release as you come home to the one. The thing is, and what I say, you know, my favorite teaching from the Buddha, three words, the Buddha said over and over, come and see. We don't have to speculate, why does it work, how does it work, where did the problem come from? Just try the thing. If the thing works, practice it so that it's automatic, and then when the panic comes or the fear comes or the rage comes, you just go, and when I go, When I'm on that upper note, I think of myself as being like a drop of
Can
water suspended in the air, and then it just melts into a warm
you
pool.
feel an anxiety attack coming, or does it just pop up on you?
I can't remember. I'll tell you the truth. I've been doing this meditation stuff seriously since 1968,
It's
and
like
I haven't had
pre-med.
any anxiety attacks in a while.
No, it's you're preventing it.
Exactly.
Interesting take on that. Well, we're going to take calls next hour from people who might have had anxiety attacks or road rage attacks, or they've been victims. So check in with us and share your stories with us. It does work, doesn't it, Dean?
It works.
It is amazing. How do people get your book?
They can go anywhere that books are sold. They can go to Amazon. They can go to their local bookstore. My website, fearlessbook.net. I've got my touring schedule and meditation audio that they can download, and also they can read chapters from my book and from my other books, and they can order it there.
I know a person who's petrified of sleeping because they think they're going to die in their sleep.
Right.
Now, what a horrible thing to live with. I mean, every night they just think about it, and they get into an anxiety attack and probably pop a pill and
And I actually have a chapter about that fear of death. It's called The Valley of the Shadow. And of course, that's
I
from the
like that
20,
time.
it's from the 23rd Psalm. And the thing I want to point out there is that in the 23rd Psalm, "Lo, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will not fear." It doesn't say the valley of death, because as you were pointing out before, death is not a problem. If, once we're on the other side of
That's
death,
it.
that's
That's
it.
it.
We're not there saying, "Oh man, I got cheated here." It's the shadow of death. In other words, it's the mental and emotional shadow, just the idea, the concept, the shadow that casts on us.
Yes, it's getting there.
Yeah.
That.
It's thinking about it.
Yep. We're going to come back and take your calls with Dean Slater next on Coast to Coast AM.